During his tenure as vice chairman, Pollock forged MCA's alliance with DreamWorks SKG, an interactive arcade venture GameWorks among Sega, DreamWorks, and MCA. In 1998, Mr. Pollock, together with director-producer Ivan Reitman, set up the Montecito Picture Company, which has produced Road Trip, Old School, Disturbia, the Academy Award Best Picture nominee Up in the Air, I Love You Man, Chloe, No Strings Attached, Hitchcock, and Draft Day. And forthcoming productions, Bastards, starring Owen Wilson and Ed Helms, and Baywatch, starring Dwayne Johnson and Zac Efron. Mr. Pollock is also the executive producer on Sony Pictures' upcoming Ghostbusters, starring Melissa McCarthy, Kristen Wiig, Kate McKinnon, Leslie Jones, and Chris Hemsworth. Mr. Pollock was born in 1943 in Los Angeles, California. He graduated with a BA from Stanford University and received his Juris Doctorate from Columbia University in 1967. He is a member of the California Bar Association and former chairman of the Board of Trustees of the American Film Institute, a trustee of the American Museum of the Moving Image, adjunct professor of film, University of California, Santa Barbara, and former trustee of the Los Angeles Music Center. Mr. Pollock has three children, Alexandra, Allegra, and Luke, and is a graduate of the Happy Valley School. And also,
last but not least,
that's right.
This is why I'm here.
The grandson of Louis Salt, for whom this theater is named. Please welcome Pop.
That's quite an introduction.
Read the whole biography.
Yeah. Thank you so much for being here today and taking the time out of your life to come share with us a little bit about your grandfather, and then obviously we're going to talk a little bit more about your life. You know, there's these giants in the history of our school that really allowed us to be here and give us the school we are today, and your grandfather's one of them. And there's things we know about him, but I want to ask you: is he's your grandpa? What was it about him that that was special for you, and what was your relationship like with him?
Well, first of all, he was the only one of my four grandparents that I actually knew, because the others all died when I was under 10. And he was not exactly the kind of grandpa who bounces you on his knee or gives you little gifts. He gave me a book about the lost continent of Atlantis. He would sit down and talk to me about the difference between transmigration of souls and reincarnation, about which he knew a lot, because that is what he was into. It wasn't that he wasn't the warm, loving grandpa, but it's that he really was existing on two planes at the same time, none of which had much room for grandchildren. I'm not being in any way negative. He was a businessman and was very good at it, and he was a spiritualist and very much into that too. Should I talk a little about it?
Oh, yes. No, please.
His father was a Jewish immigrant who came here in the late 19th century, got married, went to Duluth, Minnesota, and started a business collecting scrap metal and push carts, and built that into a company called the Triangle Steel Company. And it did really well, and eventually opened up an office in Los Angeles. But before that, in 1914, the first of his and my grandmother Estelle's children died at age 4 of the flu. And at that moment, he lost faith in God as he understood it from what I'll call the Jewish religion, and was searching around for other spiritual answers, and eventually came across Annie Besant. This was in the 20s, but and he did a lot of searching during that, you know, in the post-World War I time. And By that time, we had two more children, my uncle Alan, who's deceased, and my mom, who is 97 and still around in Santa Barbara. Yeah. And was very much started corresponding with Annie Besant, who had taken over the reins of the Theosophical Society from Madame Blavatsky and Colonel Ledbetter, the pioneers. And Ledbetter had, by that time, brought Krishnamurti from, I forget whether it was Calcutta or Bombay, but to England and educated him. And he got extremely involved with that. And when Krishnamurti left, had his break with the Theosophists, I won't go into all of this old stuff, but
there was a break
in the 30s. He went with the Krishnamurti side. In fact, he had hired, but Krishnamurti's number two was a man named Rajaraja Kopal, who was married to a woman named Rosalind Williams. Raja Kopal was the first headmistress of this school and was really, you know, one of the main forces in starting this school with the help of all of these people who did it. Rosalind's sister Irma was working for my grandfather, who by this time had moved his company out to Los Angeles and moved himself out to Ojai, actually Santa Barbara, and then to Ojai, where he built a house up in Miners Oaks that I just visited this morning. Yeah. On the way up here. It's a retreat now that I guess I was.
Which
just,
is right near the lower campus.
Right near where I've been. Yes, I'll get to that in a second. Yeah. Anyway, after Estelle, my grandmother Estelle died, he married Irma Williams, so he was married to Rosalind's sister. Oh. That's how all very close this all was. But while he not only gave a lot of money to, but he helped set up the Happy Valley Foundation. He gave a lot of money to the Happy Valley Foundation. He helped buy the land that is what we used to call the Upper Valley, but it's now the only campus, this campus that we're on.
Well, I mean, let's talk about that just for a second.
For the foundation.
Help buy the land. It's kind of a little bit bigger than that, right? It only happened because he was there and he stewarded that. I mean,
well,
there were many times that was not going to happen.
He was the businessman
yeah.
of the group of all
yeah.
of them.
Yeah.
And he had money. I mean, actually, a number of them had money, but he was the businessman. He did
yeah.
all the negotiating
right.
for it.
Right.
And believed this was. There's a lot of walnut trees here, basically. When I was, jumped a little bit ahead, but when I was here, I'll get to that in a second, for 7 years, 6 years I was at boarding school here, from the seventh grade, it used to be from seventh through 12th grades, and 3 years in the lower school where the school was and the dormitories for the younger kids and the women, and then the boys, the older boys, were up here in the Upper Valley. And we had to commute down every day in a Volkswagen bus. I now see that you have very nice... yes. Leah... Where was I?
You were talking about Louis Zal. Taking care of making sure the purchase of the land happens, and we didn't lose that. Well, I guess my question in that is, you know, if he's a businessman and had this really deep spiritual side, how did those things mesh together in terms of, like, it seems like they would be in conflict with each other.
I, quite frankly, I don't know how he did it.
Yeah.
Because it was... he could be as good a businessman as one could be. We used to come up, even before I went to Happy Valley, we'd come up to the Oak Grove and listen to Krishnamurti talk.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if any of you have read Krishnamurti or heard any of it, he's not the easiest to understand, especially when you're 10 years old. And he's always asking questions like, how do we know anything?
I talked to someone the other day and they said, well, he was such an amazing worker, but not the greatest teacher. It was interesting.
Well, I read a lot more. My own experience is, and I know, again, I'm jumping ahead, is I was sort of more or less oblivious to all of that when I was here. It's meant much more in retrospect than it did at the time. But I guess maybe that's true of all high school experiences. You survive high school, and then life happens, and then you look back on, oh, yeah, this was a really interesting high school experience compared to everything else. Anyway, so the group that included all of the famous people, you know, the Huxleys all of that stuff,
what do you think he would think of the school we are today, of what's become of what's on this land? Like, you were in a golf cart and tooled around it this morning. What do you think he would have thought of what we're here today in this theater?
Well, there's been such... I really don't want to get into the whole split I don't think the school... Today, it does not appear to me that it is terribly theosophist in its at the time they started the school, they really had a theory of education that was based on that.
Yeah,
I think that has changed. I don't really know whether it's for the better or for the worse. Maybe somebody can tell me if they can compare it. And you know, things evolve.
Right.
And so I don't know what he would think of that. We had traditions that I doubt that are still here. I don't know. Does anybody folk dance on Saturday night? No. Well, that was a big deal for all of us. The one time where we had any kind of regular dancing, once a year, it was a really big deal. Folk dancing was what we did,
right?
And it was fun.
Right.
But I've seen
some great footage. It's as athletic as anything I've seen. Is the folk dancing that went on?
Well, Michael Hathaway, would love to come up and do some prashakas with me, since we are now both in our 70s and really probably couldn't do it. But
I want to cruise forward a little bit, you graduate, you leave Happy Valley, you've gone off to college. How did you get started in the entertainment industry? In business?
I didn't have really any desire to get into the entertainment business when I started. I was sort of I was accepted at Stanford, but I went to Pomona College because Rosalind and my mom thought it would be better for me to stay in a small liberal arts school close to home rather than go away to either Stanford or Amherst, where I got into.
Right.
I didn't get into Harvard. So I went there, and then I transferred up to Stanford, where I actually roomed with Michael in Menlo Park. And you have to remember that we're in the early 60s, where Kennedy is getting shot. Kennedy is getting shot while at Stanford. The war in Vietnam is starting, a draft is being instituted, nobody wants to go to war.
Yeah.
You couldn't get out of it by, you know, it was a different time. So we were protesting. I went to law school, but basically I have a low draft number. I went to law school so I wouldn't have to go to Vietnam, because I did not want it. It was as unjust a war as most of us think the Iraq War is today. While I was at law school at Columbia, I became self-aware for the first time. And there are a lot of reasons for that. I won't go into all of them. But one of them was a movie.
Yeah.
A movie called 1,000 Clowns that doesn't hold up today, but it kind of changed my worldview. And I said,
what was it about?
It starred Jason Robards as a man who did not. I was a kid who did exactly what he was told. I got all. Well, we didn't have grades. You have grades?
Yeah.
We did not have grades here.
When I was a senior, we didn't have grades here.
Yeah.
I didn't.
So I don't know, but I got the equivalent of all A's here, and I got the equivalent of all A's.
And it was always a mystery of trying to figure out what do we really have. Yeah. You know, I think I got this. You'd read the comments and go, oh, that's odd.
Well, I'm pretty sure I got all A's, but yeah. I don't know because I've never saw any transcripts.
Right.
But it was easy for me, and it was easy in college. I had to work hard in law school, but basically I just did what I was told as a kid. I wasn't self-aware, and I didn't realize that I had any choices, because it's a different time. We're talking about the 1950s. And the early 1960s. And things changed around 1960, mid-60s, we'll say, for any number of reasons. And the movies were one of them. And I wanted to, art can change your life like that. That's something I want to do. So.
Was there someone that gave you your first opportunity to really
evolve? No, but I came back and went to joined a law firm as a, you know, just as a start, a big law firm in Los Angeles that did entertainment law.
Okay.
But I hated it. Because as all of you will find out, your first job in any business, they treat you like shit. And an associate in a law firm is no different than an assistant anywhere. You're the lowest on the totem pole.
Right.
And I quit after 6 months and basically spent the next year and a half of my life growing, couch surfing. It wasn't called that then, but that's what it's called today. I lived on various communes. I ended up back with Michael in Cambridge. We actually tried to make a movie together. We liberated, which is the hippie word for
stealing.
liberated a Bolex camera from the Carpenter Center for the Visual Arts, as I recall, and we went to the Boston Common to shoot a stop motion animation film about a baby carriage that ate babies. Which we never finished. Because at the same time, we're in early 1968, we're up in New Hampshire we're ringing doorbells for Eugene McCarthy. Who was running against Lyndon Johnson protesting the war in Vietnam.
Yeah.
And McCarthy didn't win, but he came close enough to get Bobby Kennedy into the race.
Yeah.
I immediately went to work for Bobby Kennedy. Michael did not forgive me for a long time for doing that. I came out here and did and worked in the state of California doing whatever, just, you know, driving people around, volunteering, whatever. And and I was there when he was shot at the Ambassador Hotel.
My mother was there.
Was there?
My mother was also in the building that day.
Maybe I knew her.
You might have. She was traumatized.
That's Dennis's sister.
Yeah, Dennis's sister. She was in the building that day. It was traumatic.
Dennis Rice is a former headmaster of the school.
Michael.
Yeah. I ended up working for the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. It was Hubert Humphrey against Richard Nixon. It was anybody but Nixon, of course, lost. But in the California campaign, I met somebody who woman named Joan Payton, who introduced me to a man named George Stevens Jr., who had just started something called the American Film Institute. And I went to work for him in late 1968, and right after the election, as an assistant. And he was about to start a film school in Los Angeles. And lo and behold, I was somebody admitted to the bar, the practice of law in California. And he said, why don't you come out? This was in Washington, D.C. that I went to work for him. Why don't you come out and be part of the team that's going to start this film school?
Yeah.
Which was in the Doheny Mansion in Beverly Hills. Mm-hmm. In fact, my first duty was actually doing a deal with the city of Beverly Hills to rent the Doheny Mansion for $1 a year. Anyway, so I'm working for the AFI, doing actually what sort of business affairs, managing the business stuff. I'm 26, young. That's my first job in the industry. I'm helping the film students make their movies. Great, the first year there was awesome. It was David Lynch and Terry Malick, and just. There were no film schools then that actually taught film making. And every college does now. They used to teach film history and film theory, but filmmakers didn't teach other filmmakers how to make movies.
Is that what got you excited about being part of it?
I don't know how I was going to get into this, so I ended up. All right, I'll use my legal skills somehow.
Right.
I ended up starting a law firm while I'm working at the AFI, and those were my clients, all the kids from the school.
Yeah.
I didn't have any clients. The two other got people who I knew from the old law firm that I quit, and I didn't have any clients, and they didn't have any money. So it was a marriage made in heaven. So we would charge them 5% of whatever they earned, which was a great deal for them because they didn't earn anything.
Right.
But among our first clients was a young man named George Lucas, who was just doing his first feature called THX-1138 and needed a lawyer. And then went on to do American Graffiti, and then obviously Star Wars. And with Star Wars, it was a great deal because we were able to help him retain the ownership of all the sequels, with which came all the merchandising and all of the other things.
Right.
But more importantly, when it made him $5 billion when he sold it recently to Disney.
Yeah.
It made our law firm important and famous, and so that's we're now in the late 70s. And then in 86, I went right from being a lawyer to being chairman of Universal. I didn't have to work my way up, thank God, inside of a studio. I never would have lasted.
Right.
I got to move in at the top. And I did that for 10 years. And then...
ask a couple questions about that moment. One of the things I was thinking about this interview and trying to think through, the money and involved in some of the projects, that how did you guys go about discerning and trusting the decisions you are making? So you're obviously putting a tremendous amount of resources and money into a project. Is that a really collaborative project, and it comes to you at the end, and you're saying yes, or is it? How does that work?
There's a dozen different philosophies on how to do it.
What was yours?
Well, at the time, and this was a whole different business than today. It's all about brands of Marvel Comics and DC Comics and all that stuff, and building brands. I'm in the middle of it on Ghostbusters. That's what it is. But
I'll ask you about that.
We can talk about that later. At the time, you could do a mix of movies. We could do a movie like Scorsese's Last Temptation of Christ, or Spike Lee's Do the Right Thing, and do Jurassic Park and Back to the Future. It's a you could do them both. Today, the the former would be done by specialty, the indie right. movies, or they wouldn't get done at all. Studios right. don't do those movies today. So my philosophy was director-driven, filmmaker-driven. Get the best directors you can there. Try to steer them onto projects you can sell.
Yep.
Try to keep the budgets within a range that makes sense, and then give them the freedom to do whatever they want, which is what they really want.
Right.
And let them be artists, but basically turn it over to them. That is exactly the opposite of the way it works today. So, in the studio system, it works that way if you're working for Fox Searchlight or Focus, which is what Gramercy Pictures is now called, the company that we started. It's a, which I think are the only two studio arms that do what are specialty films, which is what we call art.
was there at that time a gamble that you felt like you took and it was like, wow, that was a massive monumental gamble that paid off? A decision to look back and go, wow, that didn't turn out how I thought it was going to.
I was really arrogant and at that time, and I didn't know what I didn't know, if you know how that expression goes. I just thought, oh my God, all those people who run the studios are idiots, and I can do a much better job than they can,
right?
Because they're really idiots. But I didn't know how hard the job was. So I went in thinking, I can do the job, and I did well. These are jobs you get fired after 2 years if you don't perform. So I did well, but I think I did well because of the philosophy that I had. Steven Spielberg was already there, but if you have Steven Spielberg and you have Bob Zemeckis and you have Martin Scorsese, Cameron. They're really good. You're trying to get really good people to come to you.
How would you discern that? So they're good already, or you're discovering?
They're good already. Yeah. They're good in the case of, say, Spike. Spike Lee had done a really good little indie movie, and so we got him to come to us. Then we did five more movies with him, and we're still. I think I'm probably the only studio executive he's ever gotten along with. but he did, and we still are. Because he's naturally a combative person, wants to mix it up.
Right.
So, and with Scorsese, his passion project was to do The Last Temptation of Christ, which I had read in a religion class at college. And we had kind of a trade-off because we let him do that. We took a lot of heat for it. There were 25,000 angry right-wing Christians who came and picketed Universal, the tour at Universal.
They hadn't seen the movie.
They didn't know anything about it. Well, they were told by the fundraisers that somehow Jesus was portrayed as a homosexual,
right,
which he wasn't. And it's whatever. It was very anti-Semitic, the protest. The movie was quite good. It wasn't. But anyway, because of that, Marty then owed us a commercial movie and made Cape Fear the next year, which was, at that time, by far his highest grossing movie. And it wasn't until he made, I think, The Aviator or something like that. Anyway.
Tell me a little bit about, obviously you're in the negotiating side of it. What's negotiation? How does it start beginning and end when you're negotiating the deal?
From what point of view? When I'm a lawyer? When I'm a studio executive, a producer, they're all...
Do you sit down with Scorsese and say, we're going to let you do this art piece, and in return, you're going to guarantee you're going to do something I can sell? Is it that what?
It is with the agent.
Yeah, okay.
That's... and it was in that case with his agent, Mike Ovitz. It was that blunt. Not with Marty.
Okay.
With Marty, was giving him the opportunity to realized the movie that he had wanted to do for 15 years that no one would finance because they didn't want to take the heat from the from the Christian right.
Right.
So.
Well, share a little bit. I mean, you mentioned Ghostbusters. Why don't you share a little bit about what you're working on today and what your Montecito picture looks like and how that marches?
Well, I partnered with Ivan Reitman. Ivan did the first two Ghostbusters movies. And so...
I was a big fan of those movies.
Well, you're from that generation.
It's right there.
Sony, which bought Columbia and inherited the IP, the intellectual property, meaning Ghostbusters, they need to compete with Disney that has Marvel, Lucasfilm, and Pixar.
This is the branding aspect.
The branding aspects of it. Right? Because not only do you have movies, you have sequels and spin-offs and merchandise, and theme parks, and all of that stuff. Yeah. That if you have a hit, there's 100 ways to make money. And that's where they're all at today. Yeah. It's frustrating. Because that's all they're interested in, and if you come up with a really neat idea, they're not interested. So when we are trying to make anything that isn't in that area, we usually have to go independent.
Yeah.
And it's a lot more work for a lot less money, but we do it.
Yeah.
As when we made Hitchcock with Anthony Hopkins and Helen Mirren. We knew it. It's about a married couple in their 60s. It's not exactly going to have sequels and spin-offs and merchandise. But it is Alfred Hitchcock and all of that. And two fabulous actors. So so we figure we'll raise half the finance and get Fire Searchlight and put up some money and we got it made. And in fact, it did okay, but it didn't make a lot of money. She got nominated. Helen got nominated for. But you know, I'm really happy we made it. And
I want to make sure we leave enough time because I know the students have a lot of questions. Last question, at least for me. What is there anything about your time here that really, really shaped how and what you're doing now and has served you the best? I know. When I look back at my time, I can pinpoint a few things and go, thank the Lord I had this experience because it serves me in so many ways in my life today.
I had a feeling you would ask that question.
I'm so glad.
I was actually thinking.
I'm glad you intuited that.
Thinking about that on the way up here, and I thought about it before, and I don't know how to answer. I've stayed interested in what this school was about for my whole life.
Yeah. As your family has.
Yeah, as the family has, and all of that. And I don't know. I don't know. I'd like to think that it did. But at the end of the day, it was probably more the end of it. There was a wonderful professor here named Joseph Margon, who was an English professor, who made us read things that we might not have read in a normal high school.
Yeah,
that's not about the ethos of the Happy Valley School or the principles on which it was originally based. I think I have a reasonably strong, like my grandfather, I think I have a reasonably strong spiritual side along with a reasonably strong business side.
Right.
I believe in the Aun Apprendo motto. So I'd like to think that it did, but I can't point to something that says, okay, this was it, this was the moment. Because when I was here, and it was called the Happy Valley School, and I would tell other people, they would all, you know, of my age, No, they'd all laugh at me. You know, you go to the Happy Valley School, it's a mental institution, I'm like, whatever.
Wearing that as a badge, more like, whoa, yeah, yes, I did go to Happy Valley School, that's exactly right.
And so the whole explanation then had to be in order, and that, yeah, this is why it's now the Besson Hill School, and one of the reasons why it's now Besson Hill. And, for Besson Hill at Happy Valley,
the land is still Happy Valley, and always will be.
Right. Well, it's the foundation that owns the land, as I recall.
Yeah.
Go ahead, ask. Let your audience ask what they want. If they want anything.
Kate.
Is there any like one thing that you learned here, or like one experience that you had here that now looking back you can attribute to like that really like kind of shaped you as a person and helped you be so successful in your life?
Well, it's just a question that Kevin asked, and I don't know if there is
like any like one specific thing, like.
Well,
in terms of activities that you did,
yeah.
I had a girlfriend here, the only one I ever had in high school, that shaped me a lot. We had 6 grades, 7th through 12th, and there were only 82 students in all. There were 12 students in my grade. Tony was 2 years younger than me. And she was my girlfriend for 6 years, on and off. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of choice for any of us. If I'd stayed in L.A., I would have gone to Uni High or Beverly High or one of those places. It wouldn't have been... That wouldn't have been the same at all. I much prefer what happened here, but I don't think that's what you meant. I had classes in ceramics from Beatrice Wood. I didn't know at the time what that meant. It was just ceramics classes. Now I have 2 or 3 pieces of Beatos in my house. It's amazing. But I didn't know what that meant. I heard Krishnamurti, but it wasn't registering. It wasn't really till I read him afterwards that I understood some of what he was talking about. Perhaps I was more open to it because it was here and the opportunity was there. I don't know. My grandfather Louis died when, I was in law school, so it would have been 65, I guess, and 64, 65. And maybe he had something to do with it. I don't know, but it's a question I was actually ruminating on quite a bit.
Chris? Hi, I'm Chris, and I teach screenwriting and filmmaking here at Besson Hill. We actually have several students who are pursuing filmmaking as a major in college as they move from here into that part of their life next year. And I was just curious if you have any advice for them as to getting into the industry.
Yeah, but it's not what anybody wants to hear. I personally think that the time to pursue filmmaking is graduate, not undergraduate. I think undergraduate time is best spent in learning as much about literature, art, and every other thing that you can draw on. Watch as many movies as you can. The time for making movies is after you've actually, when you have something to say about them, but that's not the way anybody I've ever met who's in high school or even in elementary school feels about it. They want to get out there and make them right now, and you can do it on your iPhone and edit on your iPad, so, or Adobe, yeah, whatever. So it's that's what I don't know anybody who doesn't want to get started making the movies right now, and I'm sure that's how all of your students feel. But it's important to know that the Lion King is Hamlet. If you don't know it, you can't write it. And the only way to know it is to read it. So taking a course in Shakespeare is useful. It just is.
That's great. Great answer. Yeah, okay. Yeah, you.
Are there any films that have been written or in the making or have been made about the story of Annie Besant in the Theosophical Society?
About Annie Besant, I don't think so. There's a Rada Sloss, who is Rosalind's daughter, had written a book which I helped her option. I didn't feel I could make it, but I helped her option it to Warner Brothers, which was basically about Krishnamurti and his relationship with Raja Kapal and Rosalind, and his break with Annie Besant and the Star of the East, and I won't go into all of that stuff for those of
that's
you who are not
stuff.
Who are not versed on your theosophy. But and a script that developed, it was written by Ruth Prawer Jogbala, who's a wonderful writer, Indian descent, and but it did not get made because at the end of the day, it was too much a specialty film, and there weren't enough people, I don't think. But it's still there, and it could get made.
Mm-hmm.
If you're really going into the origin, Annie Besant, I mean, to me, the interesting part is Madame Blavatsky and Grant,
yeah.
and Ledbetter, the really weird times of the origins of Theosophy, and
yeah.
What did Ledbetter, but never mind. Anyway, so, but that's interesting stuff, and again, it's a small movie, but that is interesting material for a movie there.
Simeon?
What's your vision of filmmaking in the future?
Well, I'm one of those who does believe that VR is going to be a big part of the future virtual reality.
Right. Yeah.
We are, on Ghostbusters, we're doing some promotional shorts in VR for the movie. But we've just made a deal with a company called Void for an interactive experience that will come out in July when the movie comes out, where it's totally immersive. You go into the world, and you—it's not you don't sit in a seat. It's you're in a room with an avatar of your choosing. It's the this Ghostbusters is there are four women: Melissa McCarthy and Kristen Wiig. Leslie Jones and Katie McKinnon and our token male Chris Hemsworth. how many male movies have had token women? So we think this is really, really cute. He's good to have as a token male. So and he does become a Ghostbuster, giving that away. By the end of the movie. So it's fascinating stuff, and piracy being what it is, movies, it's not going to be what it currently is.
Yeah.
It's going to change. The movies are going to become bigger, but the volume is going to get larger because it has become cheaper and cheaper to make movies.
Mm-hmm.
On your iPhone, on your whatever, you can make an indie movie for $10,000-$20,000 as opposed to millions of dollars. Whereas the studio movie now costs, the average studio movie costs $100 million to make. So this gap, you're gonna see something totally. It's one of the reasons why there's such great stuff on television, because they're not constricted by a 2-hour form. And so you can experiment with character. You can experiment. It isn't about ratings anymore. It is, but it's not as much about ratings. Or it's not about 22 episodes. It can be about 12 or 6 or what. There's a lot more freedom. To be crammed in any movie that's crammed into a 2-hour theatrical experience limits the creativity of the people making it. And that's anybody who's tried to make a four-hour movie and get people to go into the theater to see it has failed. And
I saw Dances with Fools. That was just
That was under 4 hours.
That was just a carrot. You had a question here.
Yeah. I guess it kind of ties into the Simeon's question, which is, as the you've been involved with the movie industry as its most rapid development has occurred. So my question is, has it been, how have you reinvented kind of the way that you approach movie making and filmmaking in that industry? And then also with that, you said that you got into film because you decided that it was a medium that you really liked. Did you ever consider being in more of a directorial position or trying to pursue something like that? Or did you just stay with heading companies?
Two interesting questions. First of all, the movie business has changed radically and will continue to change radically, driven almost entirely by economics. Always by economics. For the first 50 years, people made movies, they were shown in theaters, and that's it. Then comes television, then comes 18 other aftermarket uses, changes all the economics of television, movies. That's still changing. That drives what pictures get made. What is shown internationally today drives what movies get made. There isn't a green light in a studio today where they do not talk about China and Japan and what movies are going to play there, because that's where the markets are. And there are certain movies that don't translate well. Most American comedies. There's a whole movement about Oscars so white because there aren't a lot of black movies, African-American movies being made. One of the main reasons they're not being made is because no one outside of the United States is interested in them. I'm saying this the day after Prince died. It's if they were, they'd be making them, because nobody cares about anything but how much money they're going to make on a movie. It's the racism is there, but it's really all about the money. So how would I change it? I don't have any control over it. What am I going to do about it? I don't have any control over that either. It's going to happen. What's going to happen is going to be driven by the economics of it.
I meant more, how did you adapt to the changing mediums?
Right. That's the second part. I tried to write. How do we adapt is, as a producer, there's what you would like to make and there's what you can make, because somebody else will give you the money to make it. So you're at this stage of my life, the worst thing that can happen to me is to spend 4 or 5 years of frustration trying to get made something that I can't get made, and fighting the system to get it made. I have done that, but I don't want to do that anymore. So I'm having to. Or at least not often. I have 2 or 3 of them, but because it can't all be those other kind. I did try to write. I wrote a couple screenplays, and they were good, but they weren't great. And as I looked at them objectively, I wouldn't have hired me. So if I'm not going to hire me because I'm not good enough, it's not what I want to pursue, and I just had to be objective about it. Now, I came up as a lawyer, and I was really adept at the business side of it, the deal making side of it. That's how I got into it. So
I'm taking 2 more questions, yeah. And then that's it. So
thank you.
Good.
You mentioned that there were core values and philosophies that Happy Valley School was founded on, and that you weren't sure if they were still around today. I'm wondering if you could speak as to what you think those were, or the ones that that your grandfather would have been most devoted to. So I think the history of the school is something we all treasure, and we try to continue to live it
and to teach it to the upcoming generation. So I wonder if you could speak to that.
I don't want to do this wrong in any way, because everything evolves. When Happy Valley started, Raymond Neutsch was here, who was in one of the first classes, I think. Where are you? Yes. Were you in the second or third class of this school?
Well, I actually graduated about 10 years after it started, but being on the board for 25 years, I just wanted to comment that I saw Rosalind juggling supporters who had different ideas, and I hadn't realized your father was so heavily into the metaphysics of theosophy, but she certainly was not, and Krishnamurti rebelled against it. So if you're having difficulty articulating what that theory was, it's because it never was articulated. It was carefully not articulated. Mm-hmm. And I remember going up to Crotona and coming back and saying that I was so interested by the library, and Ronald said, why did you go up there? So there were some people, many of the teachers, who were, like your grandfather, very much involved with that. Others, like Robert Aitken, who came later, who was a Zen Buddhist monk before he came and went on to become a head of a Zendo in Hawaii. So there was, I think what united all of them was this questioning of inner motivation and inner life and what it had to do with what you did on the outer life. And there wasn't anywhere the amount of social engagement on the part of the faculty when I was there that there is now, which I think is, I like the direction the school has gone.
The school's high school was so rigid. Public high school in America was so rigid. Mm-hmm. Private schools in America were so rigid. Mm-hmm. In the 40s and 50s, when Happy Valley was like nothing anyone else had seen at the time, although now it doesn't feel so rigid anymore. I mean, I don't even know, because the rest of the school, it was shocking to people that we would call our teachers by their first names.
It was group chat with me when I arrived on campus.
That was like, no idea, or the people would be barefoot, or that that you would learn according to your ability. I was really good at math, and I was I ended up teaching geometry to 10th graders when I was in the 12th grade, because I was good at it. And I'd already done all that. But you would not find that in any public or in any private school in the 1950s. This is Eisenhower, and America was rigid. It loosened up quite a bit in the 60s, and obviously it's loosened up quite a bit now. Now that's not the core philosophy of Aldous Huxley or Krishnamurti or Alan Watts or whoever else we want to quote, but that's how I feel.
I'm going to stop us there because lunch is waiting, and I just wanted to say, Tom, thank you so much for taking the time. I know you're busy.